Welcome to Case in Point, produced by the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. My name is Matt Marin, and I'm the Multimedia Coordinator from the Communications Department. And with me today is the law school's Chief Innovation Officer and Executive Director of the Future of the Profession Initiative, Jennifer Leonard. Thank you for joining us today.
What is the Future of the Profession Initiative, and what kinds of programs have been introduced since its inception?
The Future of the Profession Initiative, or FPI, as we call it, is a new project that the law school launched just this past October at the end of 2019. And really, it is a project that focuses on developing a deeper connection between what's happening out in the profession and how we're responding as a law school. And there have been developments such as clinical education, certainly our legal practice skills program at Penn Law, that are efforts to more deeply connect students with the profession. But FPI is really a new vehicle that allows us to deeply understand the changes afoot in the legal profession and think about all of the ways that we can respond as a leading law school. And we focus on three pillars through FPI: teaching, leading, and transforming. So by teaching, we think about the holistic way that we prepare developing lawyers to enter a profession that requires a variety of skill sets, some of which are new, things including leveraging technology in practice, running a business, whether you're at a large global law firm or you're a solo practitioner or you work in the legal services public interest space. You need to know how to be a leading manager. You need to know how to understand budget and finance and management and growing and leading diverse teams, all of those things that go into leading an organization. You also need to learn how to lead yourself. So we focus on the law school, we're a leader in integrating well-being into our formal curriculum through things like our pilot program in incorporating lawyer well-being as part of our professional and ethical obligation to our clients in all of our upper level professional responsibility programs and courses. And we are just starting to focus on a discipline, a framework for problem solving called human-centered design, design thinking, which comes out of disciplines like architecture, design, businesses, education, that really takes a client-focused approach to designing legal service delivery solutions. So all of these things go into our teaching portfolio. We are also leading profession-wide conversations about all the changes taking place across the profession and also thinking about ways that people are innovating and coming up with new opportunities for legal professionals to provide services in different ways. Some of the ways that we've done that are through our recent Law 2030 conference, which was our big coming out conference as an official project. That convened hundreds of people in Philadelphia and thousands of people virtually across the globe to talk about all the changes that are happening in the profession and the opportunities those changes create. And we're extending that experience through our Law 2030 podcast and also developing a blog series to bring in different voices from the profession to talk about change. And finally, we plan to transform the profession and specifically the way legal services are provided. We have a really unique status as a university as compared with law firms, for example, which are focused on generating profit and providing services to their clients and aren't necessarily incentivized to collaborate and cooperate with different kinds of organizations to drive change. We are uniquely situated to actually research the change and then incubate new ideas on campus and bring those ideas to life. So those are our three pillars: teaching, leading, and transforming this really important and dynamic profession.
So given the fact that we are at a university and there are a lot of different schools to collaborate with, are there any particular collaborations that you're extremely excited about within the Penn community that you've managed to build?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think one of the silver linings of being a profession that's pretty slow to the innovation game is that almost every other graduate school on Penn's campus has a very active innovation project. And many of the innovation efforts at different schools are much more mature than ours is. And that gives us the opportunity to learn from a lot of different models. So Even in the past 6 months or so, I've had the opportunity to learn from the School of Engineering, from Penn Center on Innovation, which is a separate entity on Penn's campus that offers resources and counseling to a variety of innovative efforts across Penn's graduate schools and centers. I've learned from schools that are as diverse as the Graduate School of Education, which has a Catalyst Center that focuses on attracting new business plans through its business plan competition from the broader community. So it's not only focused on Penn students and faculty, but also on anybody who has innovative ideas for designing better ways to educate the community. So we've learned from Penn GSE. We've also learned from Penn Engineering, from Wharton, certainly, which has a variety of innovative efforts. And then the Central University has the President's Engagement Prize and Innovation Prize. So there are just so many different places to learn from. I would say I haven't found one that's superior to all the rest, but we're in a stage now where we get the opportunity to learn about all these really different models. And to learn what's worked well for other schools and centers and what's not worked as well, and to develop something over the next year to 18 months that we think will work really well in our environment.
Why is it important to develop initiatives that focus on the future of industries?
Well, I would say all industries, even before the COVID-19 crisis, were changing rapidly for a variety of reasons, because of globalization, because of the rapid acceleration of technology, because of the way people think differently about their own professional engagement and working models. I think our profession is also changing more rapidly than ever before, and because our mission is to educate new lawyers and lawyers who will practice in the future, that future will look very different in 5 years than probably it's looked for most of the history of legal education. And we have an obligation to really deeply understand how it will be different and how we're responding as a law school that educates our lawyers to be prepared to lead through that change. Students come to us and they invest enormous resources, whether those resources are the time it takes to complete a degree, the money that they're investing in tuition, the energy that they put into this very rigorous academic pursuit, or just deferred opportunities, right? All of our students could be doing a variety of things, and instead they're choosing to be with us and invest with us. So we owe them a cutting-edge education that's the most well-informed and responsive of any in the country. Law is a very siloed profession in the way that it's structured. It's a closed system in the sense that it really is designed exclusively by lawyers and judges who are also lawyers. And we've had virtually no multidisciplinary integration or influence in the way that we structure what we do. We also have very little client input into how we design the systems that are developed to serve them. So I think we will struggle more than other disciplines might struggle to adapt. So it takes a really proactive commitment to carving out a project that's focused on self-reflection and understanding the limitations of that siloing, and then bringing in other disciplines to help us think differently, to develop a greater flexibility and a more nimble approach to what we do. And this initiative is exactly that. This is the way that we flex those creative muscles and develop a more nimble response to what we're doing. Also, our students are changing, right? They come to us, there's this idea of the audience of one, which is the idea that this generation of students has grown up using services and products that are virtually free and yet are responsive to their likes and the things that they are interested in and what they've enjoyed in the past. And it develops and cultivates an experience that's designed just for them. And then they come to institutes of higher education and certainly law students, and it is a very uniform model. So how are we adapting to respond to their individualized interests and goals? And FPI is one place where we can think about how we tailor differently the experience of each individual student and then practicing attorney as she enters the profession.
Are there any particular trends that attorneys should be paying attention to? How has the dialogue changed since the coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, it's such a great question. as I mentioned, we had this conference, and the conference took place February 27th and 28th, right? And I think by March 15th in Pennsylvania, we were in lockdown for COVID. So in the span of 2 weeks, all of the themes that we were talking about at that conference, whether it's regulatory reform, changing technology, designing new legal service delivery opportunities, talking about greater lawyer mobility, the need for a less rigid system of lawyer accreditation, the need for a variety of different roles within the profession, and not only lawyers being the individuals providing legal service. We were talking about all of that, right, 2 weeks before. But I would say we were talking with a group of like-minded people who are also interested in innovation. And I would say that in the two-week period that followed, all of a sudden, all of those themes took center stage, and it was no longer a more academic exercise of talking about how things are going to change and how we need to change, but a real on-the-fly forced experiment in innovation. So I think that one of the major trends that lawyers and anybody involved in the legal profession should be aware of are the regulatory reform efforts that have been taking place primarily in the western part of the U.S. And those reform efforts have been taking place for a long time. I would say that the conversations were more academic a decade ago. They were talking about how if we change regulatory structures, we could expand access to justice, but there was not a great sense of momentum or a realistic sense that anything could actually be changed. And what's been interesting in light of COVID is that the jurisdictions that have been talking about this regulatory reform for a long time, and I'm thinking of Utah more than any other jurisdiction, was able to actually act pretty rapidly as soon as the crisis hit to fast track a variety of efforts that they had been thinking about, had been advancing for some time, but it was taking a long time, as it should, because it's an important change. But because they were so far ahead of the game, they were able to condense the period for public comment, and they're moving toward a 90-day time frame to make real regulatory adjustments in that jurisdiction. Utah also adapted very quickly in the way that it licenses new attorneys because it had been advanced in the way it was thinking about those things anyway. So while all of these jurisdictions across the country are grappling with how do we administer an in-person bar exam where you're bringing hundreds of people into a packed convention center during a pandemic to take an exam, Utah had already been thinking about this. They were ahead of the curve, and they adapted a solution that focuses on automatic admission for students who have graduated from a law school that meets certain requirements to ensure that the graduates entering the profession in Utah have already established through a rigorous academic program that they're qualified to practice. And those are the kinds of adaptations that are possible when you're thinking ahead of the game. And I think attorneys have really focused on doubling down their efforts on putting every bit of energy into the fight regulation change at all costs basket, instead of thinking about if regulatory reform were to happen, how would my organization, if I'm, for example, a big law firm, right? One of the big things that could happen in large global US law firms, if regulatory reform were to take hold, is that they could then be competing with big established integrated business service providers like the Big Four. And big law firms have been fighting that for a long time. But the ones I think who are thinking about, if that happens, how do we either remain our sustain our competitive advantage or collaborate with others to also offer a more integrated business services solution will be the ones that will actually survive and thrive in the end. Because I think that even though I thought in February change was coming, I think now change is here. And the places that have already been thinking about it will do better, I suspect, than the ones that haven't. And I think that the second question that you asked about the impact that the crisis is going to have on the profession, I think that the crisis is a horrific human tragedy and it's awful. And I don't mean to paint it with a positive brush at all, but it does provide two things that real true innovation requires. To achieve real innovation, you need experimentation in a real world environment that allows you to assess what works about this change and what does not work so well. And because our model across the board from the educational model to the practice model has been so durable and so stubborn, we've really not had the opportunity to experiment in a variety of ways that give us real world data about what worked and what didn't work. I think, as I said, we're all living through this huge forced experiment in every single part of our industry and our profession right now. And we will learn a tremendous amount about what happened and how we responded on the other side. And I think we'll see a lot of failures. I don't think we'll see us move to a model of purely online legal education. I think, though, that we will recognize that there are elements of what we're doing now that we thought wouldn't work that are working better than we thought they would work. So I could see a world in which we use online learning in different contexts that are blended with traditional live real-time classroom instruction that create a stronger educational model that also gives greater flexibility to our students and to our faculty. I think in practice, other things could really have the potential to change the way we practice law and the way our profession operates. We have been so wedded to this idea that everybody has to meet in person and everybody has to come to a physical office in a big city every day if you're going to practice law with a big law firm. I think I can say for sure that I have been able to continue my professional life online. All of the law firms around the world that serve large corporate clients are continuing their work, and clients will get used to that. So I think some of those things will change. I hope that some of those changes are positive for work-life balance. I hope they're positive for retaining more women in the profession and in offering better working environments for working parents who have family obligations. So I think we're going to learn a tremendous amount in the next year or so and have the opportunity to explore what that means for the future. That's the first thing that the crisis provides to us. I would say the second thing is the variation of responses. So I was thinking about this yesterday because I was reading an article about how different countries around the world are responding to the crisis itself and how the variety of responses gives you the opportunity to learn what actually works and what doesn't. If every country around the world were responding to COVID in the same exact way, you wouldn't be able to compare different approaches and extrapolate from that comparison what worked and what didn't. And I was thinking about it in the context of law firms. Law firms have worked in a very uniform way because they by and large replicate the model that originated over a century ago. There are minor variations, but a lot of the large global law firms operate with hundreds of lawyers and timekeepers billing their times in 6-minute increments to drive profits. The firms compete during the same time on law school campuses for the best talent coming out of law schools. They compete with each other to have the same starting salary. There's just every year there's a discussion about salary wars among large law firms, and they by and large end up meeting somewhere on the same level so that they can compete with one another. They have the same partner associate of counsel model that has been very long lasting, and people who occupy roles outside of those three tend to be viewed in a marginalized way, that they're not really on the partner track or they're not part of the established firm structure. And so there's no real incentive to be innovative or to be creative in that world. Everybody follows what everybody else is doing because the risks of not following that model are too great. And you also have a profession that's pretty risk averse and again, steeped in history and tradition. So right now, what's really interesting is there isn't the luxury to look around and say, what's the best practice and what's the most prominent model here? Every firm's responding differently. So if you look at summer associate programs, for example, they're all over the map right now. Some of them are canceling their programs altogether. Some are keeping the same 10-week program and doing something virtual. Some are reducing to a 2-week program and doing some in-person networking opportunities in the fall. You've never seen this before in the legal profession, even in the Great Recession, because it's happening so quickly and everybody is thinking about what makes sense for their own firm. And after this, when we're someday through this, and we will get through this and emerge on the other side, we'll look back and learn from all of that. And I hope that we learn to think differently, and I hope that we come out with some different solutions. I think it would be a shame to come out of it and return to business as usual in the end. And I don't even know whether that would be possible after everything we've gone through. I hope this drives real positive change that we've never seen before in our lifetime as legal professionals. And what's wonderful and really exciting at Penn Law is that we now have this vehicle through which we can examine what just happened. We can use FPI to study it and be a place that convenes conversations to talk about what we do going forward and what we learned through this innovation experiment.
And I'm going to switch back to FPI itself. Could you discuss the makeup of your board and what was the operating philosophy behind getting these individuals involved?
Absolutely. I am so excited about the board that has been involved in this project. And I would say that they are the most important part in our development process. FPI would not be what it is now without the involvement of our board. So we being our internal working group and colleagues around the law school, as well as the dean, really wanted to have a project that focuses on all different places in the legal profession and not have it be a siloed project. And to do that, we needed to bring in leaders from the profession who sit at very different places in the legal ecosystem. So we brought in leaders in public interest like Jim Sandman and Claudia Johnson. We brought in leaders from the private sector like Sozi Tulante, who also brings extensive government and academic experience with him. People like Joe Borstein, who works with EY. So he represents somebody who lives in a Big Four context and thinks about regulatory reform from a different perspective. We have leaders like David Perla, who, in addition to having a really extensive background in legal entrepreneurship, now works in litigation financing at Burford Capital. So he offers a different model for funding legal work and developing new partnerships. We have Susan Lambreth, who's been consulting with large law firms for a very long time to teach them the skills their clients demand. So she very much understands the client-centric orientation for legal education that we are trying to develop and model for our students. We brought in people like Aaron Katzel and Madhav Srinivasan, who study the financial models of law firms and understand the marketplace for legal services from both a supply and a demand perspective. So we really wanted to bring together all of these experienced professionals to tell us what they're seeing from where they sit. And it's really exciting because, to be honest, I wasn't sure how a board like this would gel and how it would function when everybody was in the same room. So what would somebody like Claudia Johnson, who spent her entire career on the front lines of legal services for low-income clients, have in common with someone like Madhav Srinivasan, who's a Wharton MBA, who spent his whole career in corporate environment and now advises large law firms on how they can maximize their profit? It was a true unknown and a true risk, but in the end, they gelled so beautifully. And I've been so amazed at their mutual respect for each other and how much they do have to discuss with one another and to build upon. Because in the end, they actually all have one really critical thing in common. They all want this profession to be better. They want it to develop new ways of approaching old problems, and they want to continue building relationships across professions, which is a big focus of our initiative, is really a multidisciplinary response to innovation. And because they have this shared vision, even though they do very different things in the profession, it's really worked. And we spent a whole day with them together last fall in New York to think about what our mission really is for this project and what our early concrete embodiments through individual projects would be that would advance this mission. And without them, it would just be a vague concept of innovation in a law school. So I am enormously grateful to all of them for actually making this initiative what it is.
Great. And so what does the future look like for the profession and for students and for the support staff that keep the industry moving?
Yeah, so I think it's such an interesting question in the way that it's phrased because it asks separately about support staff. And to my mind, this has been one of the biggest flaws and one of the things that has held our profession back from true innovation, because we've created over time this dichotomy of lawyer and non-lawyer. And we actually talk about it in that way. And that places those who have a full JD above everyone else in the system. Right. And if you're a non-lawyer, it's become sort of a pejorative term that you're not necessarily fully a part of the profession and you can't bring to the problems the level of sophistication that a JD does. And for a profession that really is exemplified by our understanding and use of language, this can't be an accident. And we need to think differently about how we define the people who work in our profession with us. So if you look to our peers in medicine, they have changed and developed new roles for healthcare service delivery, right? So we don't now go to a hospital and think in the hospital about the people we interact with as doctors and non-doctors. We certainly think of doctors in a particular way, given their training, but the model has evolved to include lots of different professionals, each of whom has a very important role in the system. So we think of nurses, we think of physician's assistants, technicians, occupational therapists, physical therapists, researchers. So I think the future of the legal profession should include professionals with many different functions. Because we've been so wedded to that one model, studies have shown that somewhere between 80 to 90% of people with relatively simple legal needs have no access to somebody to help them because we haven't developed these different models. So I think that that movement is growing. As I talked about earlier, I think Utah will be the leader in showing us what different models can look like and we'll learn a lot from their efforts. I think lawyers themselves will have a lot more mobility. The idea that we're increasingly mobile but still bar attorneys to practice only in a single jurisdiction, I don't think will be sustainable or attractive to new lawyers over the long term. I think if we don't adapt, I think it becomes a deterrent to entering our profession. I think because of the crisis and because of the fact that we're adapting the way we license new lawyers and we're working remotely, I think we'll see new models emerge for lawyer licensing and for more virtual practice, which will open the possibility for practicing across jurisdictions, which has not been a viable option up till now. Another trend I see in the future is really for legal professionals to understand how leveraging technology can make practice more efficient. And I think it will become more important than ever that law schools educate new lawyers about how to use technology in practice. And I don't think that that looks like law schools teaching particular software to students, because the software will change and it's not really the important part. They'll learn that in practice. But what they need to know is which parts of a representation can I use technology to expedite and make more efficient so that I'm reserving my efforts for the part that is most complex and requires a human intellect to solve and to counsel a client. And I think that that trend will continue to accelerate.
And what are you most excited about in regards to the initiative?
So honestly, the thing that excites me the most is the thing that we haven't yet launched, which is our transformational piece. That is the longest term goal on our list of projects. And that really relates to our earlier discussion about innovation competitions and incubation and bringing new ideas to life. So because the industry has just been so set in its ways and so durable, I think there are so many opportunities to come up with new ways to deliver legal services, and I'm really excited about that. I'm excited about creating a model that attracts creative thinkers to Penn Law to bring those ideas to life and then plugging into that innovation ecosystem at Penn to give them the resources they need to flourish. That's what I'm most excited about, having real impact on the profession. Here's another example. This past semester also created the opportunity. I had been talking with Associate Dean Eleanor Barrett about launching a design thinking for lawyers seminar next fall that would put the law students in the shoes of the client to help them understand what it's like to try to access legal services. And because of the crisis, there were a few students who were graduating and needed an extra credit. And Eleanor and I worked together to develop a mini module that, you know, the students understood we were building on the fly and they were game for it. And it was really such a great opportunity to connect students with what we did was we connected them with local Philadelphia business owners who were going through the crisis and had a variety of legal needs, and they were having challenges getting good resources and good counsel around them. So we had the students walk through the five stages of design thinking and really empathize with their experience and develop. In the end, what the students developed was a web-based platform that would be easily navigable for businesses to get real-time access to resources as they developed. And then to all, they also partnered with, in this model, local solo practitioners who would charge a reduced rate, and the students would serve as the platform through which business owners could access those services. And the business owners talked with the students about their biggest frustration being a lack of clarity around how much lawyers charge for services. And they were afraid to pick up the phone and call a lawyer because they didn't know if they were being charged or if so, how much. So they worked into their design a quote system where the client would ask a question through this platform and they would get a quote back from the lawyer before they engaged. So they would know exactly how much they would have to pay the lawyer. So that was really exciting development that was only possible because of the crisis. And now that we've run it one time, we can refine it and extend it and make it a full semester offering. So that's something that I'm also really excited about. Another project that I'm excited about is we are launching our five-year out academy this fall, which is FPI's main contribution to our lifelong learning efforts. So this is, you know, the world is changing so rapidly. So people now need more advanced education to help them enter the next stage of their career. So this will be the first law school in the country to provide education to our graduates who are 5 years out on things that they wouldn't have been prepared to learn in law school, but they now need to enter the next stage of their leadership ascension. So I'm really excited about that. I'm excited to continue our Law 2030 podcast, especially during the crisis. It's an easy thing to do. And it allows us to bring really different perspectives to the broader profession and continue to advance the conversation even as we're all sort of stuck at home.
Is there anything you'd like to add before I let you go?
Actually, there is something I would like to add to an earlier answer. You asked about what I see for the future of the profession, and two things I didn't mention that I think are really important. I think the technology is changing, but I think the humans are also changing. And I think we'll see a more diverse and inclusive profession in the future. And that will also drive innovation. We've had a very uniform model for a long time. And we know that by bringing in people with different backgrounds and different experiences, we'll get better ideas for how to lead this profession. And I also think that the profession is really focusing in a way that it never has on lawyer well-being and all of the challenges that we've faced, in part because of the models that we've developed that can cause a lot of damage if we're not thinking intentionally about how we're promoting lawyer well-being. So I think we'll see healthier lawyers in the future, and I think we will see more diverse lawyers in the future, both of which are really exciting and necessary developments that will drive change.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jen. I really appreciate you joining us on Case in Point, and stay safe out there.